Trail and Ultra Runners, what is going on? Welcome to another episode of the Coopcast. As always, I am your humble host, Coach Jason Coop, and this episode of the podcast is the final in a series of podcasts that I have released over the last 4 weeks about anti-doping efforts in the trail and ultra running community. And I'm leaving y'all off with a banger of an episode and a banger of an episode that is in my new recording studio. So if you happen to be watching the YouTube version of this, hopefully the aesthetics are a little bit better, more appealing to the eye, but that is neither here nor there. Welcome to the podcast, Gabe Baida, who is a 15-year professional in the anti-doping arena. Over 10 of those years were with USADA. And in particular, Gabe was one of the most influential people for booting up USADA's anti-doping efforts within the UFC. Now, what does mixed martial arts and the UFC have to do with trail and ultra running? It's not just because I'm a fan and I'm fascinated with that sport. It is because they introduced anti-doping at a time where it didn't really exist, or it existed in a fractured nature. And that is the exact same position that we are in trail and ultra running right now. So I brought Gabe onto the podcast today to discuss what he learned from that effort and how we can take those learnings and apply it to the sport of trail and ultra running. If you are a key stakeholder in this, if you're an elite athlete, you're a race director, you're a coach, or you're a brand manager, pay attention to the words that Gabe has throughout the course of this podcast, because we don't want to repeat the same mistakes that were made in the UFC, and we have a good blueprint for how to implement this based on the program that they actually implemented. It doesn't have to be exactly the same, but the future will always repeat, even though it might not exactly rhyme. All right, folks, with that intro, I am getting right out of the way. Here's my conversation with Gabe Baida, all about his experience in implementing anti-doping in the UFC. Thanks for coming, man.
Thanks for having me, man.
This is you're popping the cherry here, popping the cork on my new setup here. I appreciate you putting up with it. I figure nobody better than you, since we've known each other for a while, to get this setup all said and done. So for the people that are watching the YouTube version, this is all new. It's usually just my face, and now I actually have a guest. I don't think you knew you were getting into that.
Well, I'm happy to be the guinea pig.
All right, sweet.
Happy to be here.
But so we're gonna spend a lot of time talking about the UFC. And the longtime listeners of this podcast will recognize that I do make a lot of UFC references, and mainly because I'm a fan, but more importantly for this podcast, it's because I think that there are parallels within what you have done with the UFC and with USADA from an anti-doping perspective, and what we can learn about that experience as ultra running is trying to figure this whole thing out. But before we talk about that, just to set the table on, you know, what you currently do and maybe to break the ice a little bit with the listeners here, I want to go back to the Sochi Olympics, which is probably one of my favorite sporting things of all time.
Yeah.
So the Sochi Olympics were known, or one of the things, unfortunately, that the Sochi Olympics were known for was this gigantic doping scandal that happened at the behest of the country of Russia and Vladimir Putin and their state-run sporting organization. And everything came out of that. You had athletes that were clearly doping. You had athletes that were not doping. You had everybody get caught in the crosshairs. And it all kind of unfolded like a spy novel, really. There were any number of different articles that were written, which I'll link a few of those in the show notes, about them. The movie Icarus, one of their primary characters, was a central figure in this whole thing. And he's still now in witness protection, I think, right?
Here in the States, I believe.
Yeah, so it's kind of crazy. But one of the key figures in that whole ordeal wasn't a person. It was actually an object, right? An object that you have now started kind of a business around trying to replace it. And that was the urine sample collection bottles. One of the things that happened as a product of the Russians trying to cheat the system is they were swapping out dirty urine for clean urine, all behind the scenes, all unbeknownst to WADA, all unbeknownst to many of the athletes that were competing. But the athletes that were involved obviously knew, because they had to give clean samples at one point. They went underneath some sort of doping program. And then at some point, those urine samples were swapped out in this elaborate scheme. And so Gabe, sitting here across from me, raises his hand and notices a business opportunity in that, which is what you currently do. So why don't you describe to the listeners like what you currently do for a living and why I had to give this elaborate background on the Sochi Olympics?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, spot on. I mean, it was a wild scandal that, you know, quite frankly, rocked the sports world, particularly the Olympic movement and the whole anti-doping system, and shined a bright light on, I think, some inadequacies that were present. But I think if there was a silver lining to that whole scandal, it was really the founding of our company, Innovero, which we basically were born directly out of that scandal. And it really came together from a New York Times article, I think, in 2016, where literally urine sample collection bottles were on the front page of the New York Times. And they were at the center of that whole scandal. And it made it really difficult for national anti-doping organizations like USADA, professional sport leagues like Major League Baseball, and some select other kind of North American groups to go to their athletes and their biggest stakeholders and say, hey, you can have trust in this system. It works. It's great. The collection equipment's good. And it just rang really hollow, right? Like, you can't have the industry standard trusted kind of piece of equipment that, you know, the highest profile athletes in the world rely on to protect their careers, be at the center of a scandal and have people trust that system. So, you know, people, organizations started looking at alternatives and quickly found there wasn't a really good, solid alternative out there that they could put their trust in and have their athletes put their trust in. So, you know, fortunately for me, you know, the likes of USADA, the US Anti-Doping Agency, and Major League Baseball pulled some resources together and founded Innovero to develop, you know, state-of-the-art, high-security sample collection equipment to better serve their athletes and the world's athletes. So,
and I think it's a good illustration on a couple of fronts. One is just entrepreneurship at its best. Sure. I mean, the way that you describe it, hey, this was on the front of the, this was on the front page of the New York Times, right?
Yeah.
This is on the front page of the New York Times. Let's make a business to try to bring some competition into the marketplace. But I also think that it's interesting from an anti-doping perspective, because we think a lot of times that these processes are very simplistic in nature. And this is part of the conversation that I had with one of your former colleagues, Tammy Hansen, a couple of weeks ago, where an athlete pees into a cup or a sample collection bottle.
Yeah.
They pee into a cup. That urine turns red or green. It's either hot or cold. We actually use that vocabulary. You know, somebody pisses hot.
Sure.
And then everything magically works out the way it should have. But even the sample collection bottle, right? Something that's fundamental, right? Somebody's putting their biology into it, right? Yeah. They're putting something that is being excreted out of their body into it, and it's getting transported to a lab. Something as quote unquote simple as that needed re-engineering and innovation, right? To use your word, to add integrity, right? Or to bring back integrity to the whole system.
Yeah, it's not unlike any other industry. Like, I've always said, you know, as we've looked at kind of the marketplace through the lens of Innovero, like, the moment you have stagnation, innovation stops. And you need innovation to continue to be competitive, and you need to have innovation in order for, you know, the market to move, so to speak, and to continue to have new user-friendly products that move the, you know, awkward, invasive sample collection process forward. You have to have innovation in that space and new initiatives going on in order to stay at kind of that forefront of kind of the industry in that way. And in order for, you know, athletes to have trust in a system and not have massive scandals happen, your equipment needs to be changing, your processes need to be changing in the training, you know, ultra marathon training world. I'm sure your training schedules constantly have to be training. So it's just, stagnation never leads to anything overly good.
Yeah, I really appreciate that sentiment in all industries, right? Yeah. Not just in sport. Okay, so with that table set, I always love that story. You, out of a lot of the people that I come into contact with and a lot of my colleagues, you have the best stories. And that's just one of them. We might talk about a few of them throughout the course of this podcast. We'll see how many of them actually bubble up to the surface, because you've got the best ones working with the UFC. So we're going to go back several years.
Sure.
And the reason that we're doing this, to kind of lay it out for the listeners a little bit, because this is going to be a trip down memory lane, is that several years ago, the UFC contacted USADA to come in and create an anti-doping program for them when one didn't really exist, or at least a fractured system existed at the time. And the reason that story and your experience is important is because trail running is in a very similar situation. And I think that a lot of listeners will start to hear these analogs as you walk through a little bit of that experience. But before we get into this, I'm going to brag on you a little bit because you're an experienced person in the sphere. You worked for USADA for almost 11 years. Yep. Nearly five of them was within this UFC program. Yep. And having done that for that long of a period of time gives you scope for the beginning, the middle, and now the end of that UFC-USADA relationship, yep, which we're not going to get into too much. And I think that is extremely important to see all aspects of that. So we're going to start at the beginning. I've been a fan of mixed martial arts way before they were on ESPN, back way before they were even on Fox Sports, when they were on Spike TV,
yeah,
way back in the day. And I remember this whole, I remember this whole storyline quite well. From a business perspective, the UFC was trying to become a quote-unquote legitimate sport. They had a very clear directive in front of them. They wanted to grow their audience size. They wanted to grow their market size. They wanted to be on ESPN, right? That was kind of one of their gold standards. And one of the pieces of that, not certainly the only piece, but one of the pieces one of the ways that they were trying to legitimize this cage fighting sport, which was ridiculed in a lot of sporting world, certainly is illegal in a lot of states. One of the key components of that was bringing anti-doping into that, into the sport itself from a not from an early stage, but at least the middle part of their business development. So they contact USADA. You're working at USADA at the time. Okay. You have worked at USADA at the time. Take us through how that initial conversation and that initial planning process actually started and looking at this new sport and how are we going to solve for this sport?
Yeah, I'm going to have to jog my memory because it was a number of years ago, but there had been ongoing conversations between the two organizations for months about what a potential anti-doping program could look like for the promotion and the sport. And I think there was a pretty healthy learning curve on both organizations' parts to understand kind of what it would look like if the two got into bed with each other. You know, I think USADA came from that kind of relationship from, here's the anti-doping programs that we've run in the past, mainly in the Olympic space, but also had dabbled in kind of the professional boxing space a little bit. So there was some familiarity with the combat sports space and kind of the dynamics and relationships that existed with some of the state athletic commissions that regulate. So, you know, I think the conversations continued to get more and more productive to the point of it made sense, goals aligned. And I think looking at it purely just from USADA's perspective at the time, you know, this was an organization that was looking to do the right thing for their athletes and to really set out to clean up their sport, and were able to get to a point where had very productive conversations on what the rules were going to be that their athletes were held accountable to. And once we reached agreements on the rules, obviously there was a financial component to it as well. But then it was really, what does it look like to implement a program for this? And that's where I came in. And I was fortunate enough, I was, you know, pretty early on in my career, and the powers that be at USADA asked me to kind of transition over to run that program. And I saw it as a really awesome opportunity and, you know, went in kind of headfirst to it and started the launch and rollout of that program.
All right. So we're going to talk a lot about what you did.
Yeah.
But let's set the table even further, because this is where the parallels actually start. So previous to USADA coming in and running the UFC's anti-doping program, they had this very fractured system to where the state athletic commissions, yep, handled various components of this. So the Nevada State Athletic Commission, California State Athletic Commission, New York, eventually at some point, once, yep, they actually legalized the mixed martial arts in that sport, and all these various states. The reason that it's analogous to ultra running is because right now, as it stands, the races are the key stakeholders in this. The races all decide, this is the rule framework that we're going to use. Mm-hmm. We're going to communicate that rule framework across the athletes in this manner Some of them are going to borrow from WADA standards. Some of them are going to kind of make up their own. Other ones are not going to have kind of anything at all. And I want you to take like the listeners through what you, how you eventually started to look at that fractured landscape within all of the different state athletic commissions, just to get your feet wet into in terms of what was actually happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's spot on. It was very fractured in that different jurisdictions, mainly the states that had these state athletic commissions that regulated the sport, all had slightly different but slightly similar rule sets. And it was very inconsistent from, I think, the athlete's perspective and from, you know, the UFC's perspective from the promotion. And when you've got, you know, some states that have, you know, marijuana, for example, as a prohibited substance, and other states that don't, and have athletes be subject to a penalty in some states for a substance, but not, you know, subject to that same penalty in a different state, just based on purely the rules and regulations that existed in that jurisdiction. I think,
or the law.
Or the law. Yeah, there was certainly that part of it as well. But you quickly got to a point where you saw the inconsistency from state to state, and you saw the need for kind of a harmonized rule set that all athletes, regardless of where they were competing, needed to be kind of held accountable to. And that's really where, you know, I think USADA came in to be able to help assist and develop, you know, that rule set that could be applied across all the jurisdictions. Although there was certainly some, you know, dynamics at play with the state athletic commission's rules still very much applied, but to have kind of this overarching rule set that all athletes were subject to made education very kind of, not, I don't want to say easy, but we could take a consistent approach on what we had to educate on so athletes could go be successful regardless of where they were going to fight.
Okay. So speaking of athletes being successful and where they're going to fight, it's beyond the US. And this is another parallel that we've got with trail and ultra running. So the UFC at any one point in time has about 600 fighters on their roster all over the world.
All over the world.
Yeah. US, Brazil, Asia, Europe, Africa, you name it.
Yep.
They've got them everywhere. All different languages. Yep. And here's Gabe raising his hand in the USADA offices just a few miles from my house right here, saying, I want to figure out how to implement a rule set and anti-doping across all those athletes in every single country. And not only that, there's also an ecosystem baked around all of the athletes. In most cases, they have a coach, they have a trainer, they have a nutritionist, they have any sort of other gurus, you know, kind of in their surroundings that are now influencing the athlete on any number of different things: supplements, training, diet, nutrition, sleep patterns, all these other things. And That's a job that I wouldn't want, but yet you raised your hand and you wanted a big part of it. I don't even know where to start, because the athletes themselves and where they are located is enormous in and of itself.
Yep.
So you can have the floor, because you went through the entire process. Where did you like start to communicate the rules? What are the rules? How are we going to go and implement them? What are some of the initial things that you had to take on to solve for this problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's something good about being young and naive, I think, right? Like you don't know until you know, right? Type of approach. But what a fun challenge, right? Like to look at that program and not fully appreciating kind of the scope and breadth of what it ultimately was. But, you know, I don't have the exact numbers. At one point I did. I think there was athletes in 46 different countries speaking 18 different languages that came from various like educational backgrounds, right? Like you look at some of the athletes that we had to educate, like some of them didn't, you know, read or write past an eighth grade level. So how do you take, you know, complex, intricate anti-doping rules and communicate it to an athlete who's never even heard of anti-doping and then allow them to be successful in that program? That was a really big challenge. And that was kind of front and center in our minds as we started launching that program. We knew once the rules were established, like education was a paramount part of that program. And being able to educate as many athletes as we possibly could was the first kind of key piece that we needed to tackle when implementing that program. And as, you know, we hashed out kind of our implementation plan, you know, we had to get in front of athletes. So like we sat out on the road, like we literally were on a traveling road show for the better part of like 6 to 9 months. And I mean, we hit every major gym in the US, every major gym in Brazil, I think we were in Japan, Australia, all
throughout
Europe. I think
we're in Japan. I think we're in this country, way across the ocean.
It was all a blur at some point. Like, it was literally just, you know, from one country to the next to educate and get in front, of course, the athletes, but also encourage athlete support personnel to come, to your point, the nutritionists, the coach, the trainers, whoever else touched the athletes or had an impact on athletes kind of lives and careers. We wanted to make sure they were educated, or at least had the chance to be educated, on what this new program was going to look like. So the education piece was so important to, you know, building a strong foundation to, I think, ultimately set that program up for a certain level of success that we saw.
So one of the things with the education piece that you and I and some of your colleagues and I have talked about is, because it's new to the athletes, you expect to receive a certain amount of pushback on any component of the system, the framework, the actual doping controls themselves, you know, the ATOM system and the whereabouts system and the banned substances and the banned methods and things like that. I wonder if there's an easy way to kind of encapsulate just some of those types of pushback that you were getting from the community as you were going on this like epic roadshow around the world to educate these athletes and their teams that are around them.
Yeah, I think there was an anticipated level of hesitation, you know, with the program. We went to gyms and, you know, kind of had our standard deck of education materials that we would run through and talk to athletes about. But, you know, more importantly, I think tried to keep it very conversational and open it up for questions. And I think the question we most commonly got was, well, how does this impact me? Right? Like right. This new program, these new rules, like, how does it impact me? What's it going to do to my career? What happens if I test positive? What happens if I inadvertently test positive? Like, all these different questions, I think, started to get, you know, the wheels turning in a lot of fighters and coaches and trainers' heads of, okay, how do we map out a plan to success for our athletes with that? So, you know, I don't recall any like specific kind of items of pushback. Like, the whereabouts piece is always a little bit of a concern for athletes.
Can you describe that before you go forward, just so everybody understands what that means?
You know, in the Olympic space, as well as in the UFC program, you know, athletes were required and are required to provide their whereabouts 365 days a year, 24/7. And I think at face value, and by whereabouts, I mean like, where are you going to sleep at night? What are your training locations? What time are you going to be there? And then if you're going to jump on a plane and you want to go to Arizona for training, you need to update and tell us that. Or if I want to go on vacation with my family to Mexico, you need to update and tell us that. So like,
and the purpose of that is?
The purpose of that is to be able to locate athletes anytime, any place for no advance notice testing. Essentially. So, you know, this is probably one of the biggest burdens that are placed on athletes that, you know, participate in a pretty thorough anti-doping program, is having to provide their locations 24/7. Like, it's a huge burden, and no one's really figured out a good way to get around that yet.
Yeah. The athletes are just like, chip me. Just like literally put a GPS, you know, chip on me. Right, yeah, and then you know where I'm at.
Exactly. And as technology, you know, continues to evolve and develop, and obviously our smartphones are great tools, you know, for that. But we've yet to see like a full-blown GPS tracking solution out there that allows athletes to just say, you know what, I'm going to opt into this and let, you know, the person who's supposed to test me find me with based off the whereabouts app. Like that I think is ripe for opportunity. But we're not there yet. And back to kind of your original point of gives more context on whereabouts, like it's literally providing your location 24/7. And that comes with some teeth on it. If you don't do it and you don't do that three times in a 12 or 18 month period, I can't recall exactly what the window is at this point, but you could be subject to a suspension.
Yeah.
So it's a really integral part of those anti-doping programs, but it comes with a huge burden on athletes.
Well, and it's interesting also because some athletes previous to being subject to any sort of doping control will literally go off the grid for their training as part of effective training. Yeah. I just want to go and isolate myself in the mountains and train like a monk, right? And I don't want anybody to talk to me. I don't want to have any contact intentionally.
Yeah.
And other athletes will want to do that to dope. Absolutely.
It's a really fine line. And I can think of instances, you know, with a global program that we were running. Like, I can think of examples of in Russia in particular, we're trying to show up to test athletes in Russia, and it was a town in Russia that you've never heard of. and they literally were 3 miles up a mountain in some mountain hut training. And their point was, I physically can't provide a location because no address exists here, right? Yeah. So like, it's that fine balance of looking at this from one, a sport perspective and where athletes train and live, and not everything is US centric too, right? Like we don't all have a physical address that's 1234 Main Street and you can find me here 24/7. You know, I got to imagine in the kind of ultra trail running space, like you're literally off the grid for days at a time.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, and once again, to your point where not everybody has an address, that's quite common in Europe, right? How do you go and track somebody down? So certainly a point of consternation. Okay, so you're going in and you're traveling around, you and your posse, you and your USADA posse. You're going and traveling around to all of the gyms and to all the fighters and to all their networks around the entire world and all of these different and all of these different languages. One of the things that I found interesting and unique about the program rollout that I think is worth discussing is this period of no fault that I don't know what the origin story of it is. And maybe you can actually clarify this for me, but there was a period of time that USADA was going through their anti-doping program, just like they would with their entire roster of athletes, but there was no consequence to it. Why don't you explain like how that originally formed, like what the idea of that is and what everybody learned from that, both USADA and the fighters and their teams learned from that whole process.
Yeah. I mean, I think at face value, it was a huge, like, this is going to be a fair program and we're going to put athletes' interests first. Like we didn't want to be in a situation where we were leading lambs to the slaughter. Right. And I think that was really important in that the education component was critical in that you can't have athletes subject to a robust anti-doping program without them knowing the rules very well, or at least having the opportunity to know the rules very well. And they need to know what can they put in their body and what they can't put in their body. They need to know the risks associated with, you know, dietary supplements and risks with being associated maybe with a certain medical practice or whatever it may be. So, you know, that period of no fault was primarily for us to give us a little bit of a runway to get all the education we needed done in that initial kind of 6 months of the program launching.
That's a lot. That's kind of what I was getting at. Like it's 6 months. It's not only you and your team traveling around.
Yeah.
It's this 6 month no fault program that you had, all in an effort to initially educate the athletes and the people around them. Now, I'm going to ask you this next question as Gabe being removed from it with some sort of clarity now that you've kind of seen it transpire. Was it enough? Was all of that effort, was it enough? And if it wasn't, are there areas where you would have gone back and said, I wish we would have done X, Y, or Z differently?
Was the 6 months enough?
The whole thing, the education and the no fault piece.
Yeah, that's a really good question to think. So yeah, like being 6 years removed from that program and that job and looking back at, you know, the level of effort was made to educate athletes and give them that period of time to kind of assimilate to the new rule set, I think was adequate. And I also think you should appreciate that it was also a stair-stepped approach to the implementation of the testing. And that's where the teeth of a program really come in, right? Like the rules are really important, but the rules don't do a whole lot if you're not out there doing testing, right? And then getting results back from a laboratory. So while we spent, you know, a 6 month period educating, when we started implementing the actual testing program, it wasn't 0 to 60. It was, I think we just started primarily like in competition testing. Right. So at events, and you'll hear a lot kind of in the anti-doping circles, well, in competition testing is kind of an intelligence test in some ways, right? Like that you had the state athletic commissions testing primarily in competition. So you always knew the possibility that you could be tested in connection, you know, with that. So, you know, I think by way of focusing on education for 6 months and then taking a stair-stepped approach to implementing a full program, I think it was close to 18 months before we had a full-blown program in place that we were contracted to do.
And that context is really important. That's a big commitment.
Yeah.
It's not turning on a light switch all of a sudden from one side to the other. Like you have a you don't have a program. And then 1 month or 1 week later, you have a program. You all being the experts are deliberately taking this, to use your vocabulary, a stair-stepped approach in order to make sure that everything is fair and also to give opportunity to like work some of the kinks out within any number of different places where that's just going to happen. A worldwide system where you've got so many different moving parts, and also the consequences of the results are very high as well. Right. Results meaning a lot of different types of results, the athletic results, the results of the anti-doping program, the results of the monitoring system, kind of everything gets lumped into that. A lot of people will come up with the criticism or have the impression that it's just too much. Like it's too complicated. Why don't we just test for EPO and testosterone and then give lifetime bans for everybody? Why does it have to be that complicated for the people who are thinking that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question. I think it's a fair thought. You know, as someone who's spent most of their career working in anti-doping, you know, I think I probably understand and appreciate kind of the intricacies and ins and outs of the system better than the person probably listening to the podcast, right? You know, and I think the answer is athletes or, and not only athletes, just people that want to exploit the system can find a loophole and a small loophole in they can drive a truck through it quickly if they want. So I think
Russia brings the KGB in.
Right. Like,
they're going to find a way.
We're going to find a way. So I think, you know, from a overall system perspective, like you need to keep it as tight as possible, but you have to balance that with the athlete fairness piece. And it's this constant kind of balance and song and dance of, in order to have a super strong, robust anti-doping program, we have to have X, Y, and Z. But the impact of that is often, man, that's a huge burden on athletes. And then, you know, I think there's the kind of value proposition component to it as well of, you put all these resources, you put all this money, you put all this effort, and you get, you know, less than 1% of athletes that typically test positive.
Yeah, that's the criticism.
Of it, right? But it's, you know, I think it's something that will never stop being asked. Yeah. And the moment it is when the market becomes stagnant and people are saying, oh, we're good, we can be complacent now. Yeah.
I remember, once again, I'm a fan. I'm going to come at this from a fan perspective. I remember when this rolled out to the UFC, and the criticism across the first 6 or 12 months of the program was, if drugs are this big of a problem, because that was kind of part of the pitch, right? The culture is rotten. Everybody's on testosterone and steroids and everything else. We're going to come in and fix this. If the culture is rotten and USADA comes in with, you know, the superhero cape, you should catch some cheaters. And I think within the first 6 months of the program, there were like two positives. It was a very small handful. And the criticism that emanated from that was one of efficacy, right? You're not catching people.
Yep.
And I kind of look at it as, you know what? They did a good job educating the athletes in advance and weeding everything out so that so that people didn't get caught up in the system like later on down the road. But I get both sides of that, right? And so I just remember, I just remember that unfolding in real time as being a criticism, but it is something that you have to balance, right?
Yeah, certainly. And I think as we looked at that program, we wanted to catch intentional cheaters in that process. Like, it doesn't do USADA any good, the UFC any good, any organization that's running an anti-doping program to go out and just pick off every unintentional cheater, right? Like, and that's where I think the criticism of it was, in part because we took 6 to 9 months to educate, and it gave athletes an opportunity to change a behavior. Right. Like if and we heard obviously all the rumblings coming in, it's a dirty sport. Athletes are intentionally cheating. And again, I go back to, we didn't want to be in a situation where it was lambs to the slaughter. It was, we need to be fair and measured in our approach. We need to give athletes an opportunity to know what the rules are. And we need to give athletes an opportunity to change behavior.
Yeah. Change behavior, meaning they're using a prohibitive substance beforehand and now they need to not use it.
Right.
I mean, I hate to like cut through it that sharply, but that's literally what you mean.
That's literally what I mean. So you need to change that behavior, right? And you couldn't do it just necessarily overnight.
Of course.
So I think, wrong or otherwise, was it harshly criticized, 6-9 months in of where are all the positive tests? Why have only two people been caught? I just hope that gives some context as far as, we took a very fair and athlete-friendly approach as we tried to implement that program.
I think the learning lesson from that is you always have to take a long-term viewpoint with these things. You can't evaluate it off of 12 months of success or 18 months of success or even 24. You got to look like 5 or 10 years out down the road. And everybody always holds cycling up as the example, but it actually is a good one in this case, right? Where it takes so long to weed out bad culture and bad behavior and so long to put systems in place where you have to relentlessly kind of attack it on all fronts. It is not simple nor quick. And the solutions to it, I remember our mutual friend, John Frothingham, telling me this years ago, the solutions to it are never perfect. They are always going to be met with some level of imperfection. And the pathway through that imperfection, to use your vocabulary again, is to stair step up or ratchet up what you are doing over periods of time. You're using an iterative process.
Yeah.
To solve for this problem.
100%. I mean, there is no perfect system. I think it's the pursuit of that perfect system that we're all, focused on. And you look at the vocal critics of anti-doping out there now, not from kind of the outside looking in at anti-doping, but people that are, career people within anti-doping. Yeah. That are always constantly trying to improve the system and trying to improve the governance and trying to improve, the prohibited list or whatever it may be. Like, there's this constant focus on continuing to improve, continuing to enhance to make it a more fair, more just, more athlete-friendly system.
Yeah, and that's something that I think a lot of people don't realize that goes on behind the scenes. USADA has always been a great advocate towards WADA and changing things like that, whether it's procedurally or things on the prohibitive list, which get changed every year.
Every year.
And normally USADA has a little bit of a thumbprint on those types of changes. And I think that should absolutely be recognized. Okay, so let's try to solve for this problem, right? We've gone through your experience and now we get to kind of publicly pick your brain on how we can solve it for ultra running. You know a little bit about the sport. You and I have conversed a little bit. I've also had a conversation with my colleague who you've now been introduced to, in Corinne Malcolm, who's head of the Professional Trail Runners Association's anti-doping working group. I had a conversation with her in a podcast that was released last week, mainly on kind of the business side of it.
Sure.
So how do we solve this as a business? So we're going to leave that side of it out, right? Okay. We're going to wave a magic wand and we're going to fundraise $5 million or whatever it is. It's not that much at the end of the day. It's manageable within our ecosystem, but we'll put that aside just for conversation's sake. So let's say we have the money. We have a chosen anti-doping entity to manage it. Let's just call it USADA. It could be the AFLD. It could be anybody else, but they're going to kind of operate with a similar blueprint. What happens next? If I were to hire Gabe away from your current business right now and said, hey, dude, like, solve this for us, knowing what you know about the community and about how the races operate and where the athletes are located and what the coaches are dealing with and all of my personal gripes that I've brought to you over the years, how would you start to solve for this?
I don't think it's rocket science. I think the blueprint is there. In my mind, the piece that seems to be missing is kind of this unifying body that brings kind of athletes together and races together and is able to put together a rule set that everybody can agree to on that. And then from there, I think it's not hard to go out and find the service provider to be able to administer that program, is how I understand the space based off my conversations with you and based off this my conversation with Corinne. So I just, what does it take to get?
Yeah, if it's so easy, why don't we have it yet? Yeah, Come on, bro. So
I don't know the space well enough to, wage my wand and snap my fingers to say, voila, it's done. But yeah, I guess a question back to you is, like, what would it take for that to happen? And then I think the anti-doping piece falls into place fairly easily. And there's a real well-mapped out kind of pathway and blueprint to follow when that happens.
Well, so what has gone on in the background, and I think a little bit what you're alluding to, is I've spent a few days with your former COO, Matt Sticchio, mapping this very thing out. And it didn't take us very long, to be quite frank with you. We came up with a framework in, I don't know, two or three different brainstorming sessions that maybe took 90 minutes a piece with a couple people in the room. And that framework is, it's not perfect, right? To alluding to what I was discussing earlier, it's not perfect, but it's reasonable to start with. And finding the organization certainly isn't the linchpin, right? Or finding the service provider certainly isn't the linchpin. I think there's a small hurdle in finding the funding for it. And mainly it's not the total amount of funding, because the industry is big enough. Like, there's enough economy going around that if we whittle the pool down to 100 or 150 people, which is probably what we're talking about, that's not that much money. It's the multi-year commitment piece that is the biggest deal, because I think you have to look beyond three or 4 years. You've got to look 5, 6, 7 years, and having a secured source of funding is a lot scarier when you look that far down the road. But the thing that I kind of keep coming, and certainly the willpower is there. The athletes want it. The race directors want it. The brands want it. The coaches want it. I'm raising my hand. That's why I've been doing this for, you know, the past few years. I certainly want it. So the willpower is there. There's a coordination effort that I think is kind of really lacking. There needs to be a person or a few people in a leadership position to galvanize all of the different stakeholders in the community to make actually everything happen, not just theorizing it in meetings and coming up with frameworks like I've done and things like that, like actually sitting down and doing the work. And the difficult part in that is somebody's got to raise their hand and volunteer to do it. And that's a hard person or people to find.
Sure. Do you think it's the chicken and the egg in that, and we're not going to talk about the business side of it, but if the funding was there and you said, hey, in year one, we've got $250,000 that is going to go towards standing this up. Like, if you hired the right personnel, would it happen, or
that,
could it happen?
That would reduce a barrier to entry if you had funding for people to actually work instead of be volunteers for it.
Yeah.
That would reduce a barrier for entry. I don't know if that's the biggest one though, because at the end of the day, you can look through the window a little bit and see how this can play out. It's a self-appointed position for all intents and purposes that is probably, even if you do some fundraising for it, that's probably pretty poorly paid.
Sure.
Or not paid at all if you don't get fundraising for it. That is rife with controversy. You get all of the criticism and very little of the kudos, and not a lot of people are going to stand up and raise their hand for that. There's a lot of people that should, because there's people in the community that will, you know, do any different number of things to bitch and moan about stuff. But for the people to actually take action, I really hate to cast a shadow of a doubt on the community, because the community is actually quite wonderful. But to find that person is not an easy thing, or for that person to emerge is not an easy thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain component of it that it's kind of thankless work in some ways. Like, you better be comfortable being a bit of a punching bag for the first year, 18 months.
Coming out from personal experience. So,
it's fine and it's good, because it's the right thing to do. And I think you can be principled in your approach, you know, as you look at that type of opportunity. Like, it's a selfless job in that you're doing it for the good of the sport and for the good of sport as a whole, not just trail running, right? Like, and, you know, to draw parallels back to previous experience, like, you want to do what's right for athletes and you want to see the best athlete win. And if performance is being artificially enhanced, like, does anyone want to see that person win?
Who's your analogy then? Like, if we go into the trail and ultra space, do you need a team of people that travel around the world to all the training venues and, like, get in front of people to educate? Like, what is that piece? Because I think that's important.
Yeah.
It's something that you've mentioned. That's something that Tammy's mentioned. That everybody, every time I have this conversation, recurring theme is we have to get in front of athletes somehow to tell them that these are the rules. Here's how they're going to be implemented. Here's what's coming down the pipeline. Be ready for it, because ultimately it's your responsibility, your strict liability.
Yeah.
How does that emerge in this space, right? Because here's the difference where you have to kind of put your brainstorming hat on. In the UFC analogy, or with any other NGB, it's the NGB saying you have to play a part of this.
Sure.
You have to.
Yeah.
You want to be a fighter in the UFC? This is the deal. Sorry, bro.
Yep.
Sorry, ladies. This is absolutely a part of the deal. It's baked into the entire system. Here, sure, we can determine a pool, but there's got to be a committee that determines who the pool is. Mm-hmm. And that I guess that institutional way of getting an athlete into the right organizational system doesn't exist. So how would you think that this group solves for that?
I think you've got to find a starting point. And you and I have had enough conversations where, you know, it's probably not going to happen overnight. And you're going to take some baby steps to slowly get to the point where you'll be able to consider a bigger, more robust program. And there's certainly some high profile races now in the ultra space and trail running space that pay really good money. What are the anti-doping requirements or drug testing requirements from these races that are, you know, well-sponsored, well-funded, you know, probably PE backed, you know,
who knows is the answer.
So,
to that.
You know, I just, at what point do the races start really, you know, caring about, we want the people that are competing in our race to be clean.
Can the races do that? Can the races say, hey, listen, we want to do out of competition testing for this group of athletes?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Coming into the race. I mean, certainly that's not the most complete solution.
Yeah.
But would there be anything prohibiting a race? Let's just say the Pikes Peak Marathon, right?
Sure.
USADA does the Pikes Peak in competition drug testing. But could they raise their hand and say, you know what? If we're going to pay for, you know, Gabe Bida's entry, we're going to test him for the 6 months leading into this race and whatever other athletes that we're going to give entries to. Is that prohibitive anyway, or is that a reasonable starting point that races could actually, once again, waving the magic financial wand here?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really answer that, but I'm trying to think back to some of the other similar experiences that I've had where, you know, we've had private groups that came to us while we were at USADA and say, hey, we're going to contract you for like boxing, for example, and we're going to enter an agreement with you, and you're going to do the in competition testing at the fight, but you're also going to do 12 weeks before you're going to run out of competition testing. So I suppose.
And they're telling you who the people you're actually testing are.
Yeah.
They're determining the pool, essentially.
Right. Correct.
The person you're contracting with says it's these people.
Yeah.
You don't need to get involved in figuring out who these
people are.
We're going to tell you that.
Yeah. So maybe there's some parallels there with individual races, where, you know, we know the athletes that are going to be running in our race, and as part of, you know, the agreement we sign as an athlete to run in that race, the jurisdiction applies back X number of days, X number of weeks, where they can be subject to, you know, various anti-doping procedures. Like, I also think about the state athletic commissions in both boxing and the UFC space, where I think as soon as the state athletic commission licensed the fighter in their state, they had jurisdiction to test them, type of thing. So not apples to apples, but not far off is kind of my thinking there.
Since we're kind of on this subject, I wonder if you can explain to the users, when there is a private contractor, who determines who in the pool is getting tested, right? So we know who the pool is. It's 600 fighters, UFC, you sign on the dotted line, you're now subject to this.
Yeah.
How does it happen that fighter A gets tested 10 times a year and fighter B gets tested twice a year and fighter C gets tested one times a year? How does that transpire?
Yeah. I mean, at USADA, we had a pretty robust kind of risk assessment tool that drove a lot of that. You know, there's some probably behind the scenes things that I can't necessarily talk about, but, you know, a lot of the biological data that you get from results obviously drive, you know, kind of future testing plans.
So you're looking at an athlete's biological profile and saying, this looks funny, or you have a program that says this looks funny or this doesn't look funny, and you apply
an abnormal result that we got. It's not a positive test, but here's an abnormal result that may trigger some follow-up testing, you know, as a result of that. I also think as you look at, you know, the UFC program in particular, but probably some parallels to the trail running space. Like, how often is an athlete competing? Are they running one race a year? Are they fighting once a year? Are they fighting five times a year, three times a year, whatever that number is, right? You know, there's something that went into kind of driving our testing plans that coincided with how frequently was that athlete competing as well. In the UFC program in particular was you know, it was really important to make sure we had athletes tested in advance of them being like fighting and having results back as well, because being a combat sport, man, it was a ton of risk with, yeah, if you've got an athlete that goes and fights and then you get a positive test and that athlete inflicted serious bodily harm to another person, there's a liability element to it as well.
So you have to get the test back and potentially adjudicate it in a reasonable enough time, yeah, to clear an athlete to fight another opponent, is what you're saying.
Correct. Yeah. And we had, you know, mechanisms built in where you could expedite adjudication processes to have, you know, a decision, you know, right, wrong, or otherwise, as far as, you know, whether or not that athlete should be able to compete.
So the pool, first off, to kind of encapsulate the question and answer really quick, the pool is created by an external organization. In the UFC's case, they say, listen, this is the 500 or 600 fighters that you have jurisdiction over.
Yep.
USADA is then determining, here's how we deploy whatever, however many tests you had budget for, yep, right? And we're going to use some intelligence to do that. We're, yep, going to, it's not going to be completely random. We're not throwing everybody into a random number generator and just drawing names out of hat. Right. We're going to use some intelligence to direct those resources the most efficiently in the most effective way possible. If you need to balk on this question, that's totally fine, because I know there's a lot of stuff under the hood that you're not at liberty to talk about. But I was wondering if you can divulge a little bit of what goes into that intelligence. What directs Johnny is going to get 10 tests and Susie's only going to get one test? Is there anything that the listeners would appreciate to know in that whole process that you can like elaborate on?
Yeah, I think at a high level for sure. And I touched on a couple of them already, like competition schedule, how often you're competing, you know, biological data that we get back on tests that have been completed. And obviously each one of those tests is screened for a panel of, you know, prohibited substances, but also looking at, you know, various biological markers that may be indicative of performance enhancing drug use. And if any of those, you know, kind of markers come back that we see that isn't enough to warrant kind of a actionable positive test or something to move forward with, you know, pursuing kind of a rule violation, then at a minimum, it may trigger a follow-up test. So it's very strategic in that regard, in that it's not just, you know, thrown at the wall to see what sticks and saying, hey, we're going to test this athlete 5 times, this athlete twice, and this athlete not at all. I mean, it's very kind of incremental in that we're obviously going to start with a first test, and that first test may trigger another test, and that second test may trigger a third test. And then, oh, this athlete is running or fighting in 3 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 months, whatever it may be. Oh, here's a marquee event coming up. It's the Super Bowl for the sport. Is, you know, it's a big money purse. You know, is there a higher incentive to dope based off of, you know, the financial reward that may exist with that? So all those factors, you know, play into what that kind of strategic testing plan is and looks like.
Can I go back to the blood biomarker piece that you mentioned at the beginning of that answer? And maybe I can come up with an analogy that you can either refute or confirm. So in the running world, because I've heard of this done in in anti-doping circles, you'll look at hematocrit and or hemoglobin as potential for somebody using EPO.
Sure.
So you might not be able to detect the EPO, but you're detecting the hematocrit and or hemoglobin increases, which then gives you the ability to turn up the testing. Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not a scientist, so I don't know the specific ins and outs with, you know, the red blood cell counts and the hematocrit levels and those, you know, type of measurements that they're doing. But yes, like as you look at, I think, the biological data that comes in, it could trigger follow-up testing for specific, you know, substances that may be thought that could be being used as a result of those.
How much does the anonymous tip line fall into the equation?
Yeah, that was actually really interesting during my time at the UFC. Like, you had dynamics with obviously guys fighting each other, and then you had competing gyms and competing. You know, our tip line was pretty active.
It sounds like a very politically correct answer. So, our tip line was pretty active.
But you know, that
your phone was getting blown up.
Yeah. That being said, there was a pretty well-established process where USADA has a team of investigators that would seriously look into those tips and determine whether or not they were actionable. So just because we got a tip didn't mean it was, oh, we're throwing the kitchen sink you know, from a testing perspective at this person. It was, no, we'll put it in the experts' hands. We'll let our investigators look into it, and we'll let them come back and say, yeah, there was some actual information here that we think you should follow up of, or I think this is bogus and you shouldn't consider it seriously.
But the fact of the matter is USADA gets a lot of valuable information from that anonymous tip line.
Yeah.
Like they, in all my interactions with them, they have always encouraged people, if they know anything about anything, to go ahead and contact that, because they have a resource set up to do just what you went through, to filter through the nonsense to get to something that actually might be actionable.
Yeah, I think they get a ton of data from it. I mean, again, being 5-6 years removed from it, I'm not sure what it looked like today, but I think it's an important piece of, you know, providing not only athletes, but people who may know of, you know, inappropriate activity going on that can report it in an anonymous way and not be kind of viewed as that snitch in some ways. So
I imagine I'm kind of throwing the fighters underneath the bus. They're all typically very lovely people, but I imagine that's at least a point of consternation because of the competitive nature of that sport and because of the personalities within that sport as well. They're absolutely going to think that there's a conspiracy theory against them that they got tested, you know, 6 times in the last 2 months or whatever, because it's so-and-so in the rival gym that, you know, like bugging the anonymous tip line the whole time.
It actually got to a point where, you know, we saw fighters wear tests as a badge of honor. It's like, tests I have, the cleaner I can demonstrate I am, like the more it's beneficial to, I think, their personal brand. So we definitely saw kind of the testing piece as a badge of honor that athletes, you know, did. Kind of took upon themselves to make it that. Not by no means was it us promoting that.
We started to see this in the trail and ultra space. The last conversation we had, I mentioned this, is with the AFLD, which is French anti-doping. They've somehow co-opted some of the elite French trail runners into their system like an athletics athlete. So like any other track and field athlete. And I don't profess to exactly know what the mechanism behind that is, whether it's like a club type of license, like we see here at USA Cycling or whatever. But one of the interesting things that I've seen come about because of that is the French athletes that are now part of it are now putting that out on social media, just in the vein that you mentioned, which is as a badge of honor. Like I've kind of made it, you know, and like, hey, listen, like this is part of the gig. Everybody get, you know, kind of get in line.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have always looked at kind of the collection process as an inconvenience, but I've seen just still, you know, following folks on social media of like people embrace it a lot more. And when they get that first test or that second test, it's like, I have made it. I'm an elite enough athlete now to be drug tested. And there's something like admirable about that, I think.
Mm. I want to go down the road a little bit further now. And we've talked about like the whole setup. Right? How to set it up, how to go and educate the athletes. You have to have a system. Everybody has to kind of agree upon the rules, even though we might agree to disagree on some of them. We're going to have somebody implement the testing, somebody do the results management. But at the end of the day, athletes get caught and athletes get caught cheating. How did you like go around the gyms and like counsel the athletes on that particular process? Like somebody in here, just as a proportion of math, right, is going to have to go through that process.
Yep.
Like what was that like?
Yeah, nothing stands out really when we were going through that process of, you know, educating athletes on that process. I mean, and we spent a good time, you know, educating athletes on how not to get yourself in that process. And I
how
think
not to get tripped up in the system or how to like,
right. And again, we didn't want to lead lambs to the slaughter, and we didn't want to, you know, catch unintentional cheaters or punish unintentional cheaters, I think is kind of the more important piece. You know, with that, but I think the important piece is there is a process in place that allows for a fair and just outcome. And if you took a supplement that was contaminated and it was relatively low risk, for example, there is a pathway for you to essentially get out of jail free card type of thing. And I think it's also important as you look at the programs, you know, you always have the opportunity to go to an arbitration where you have an independent arbitrator, you know, hear your case. So it's not necessarily, you know, USADA making the decision on that. Like, yes, they make the initial decision, but if the athlete doesn't agree with that decision, they have the opportunity to go have an independent arbitrator hear that, where both sides can present their case and it's an independent person, you know, who makes that decision. And I think, you know, kind of the scales of justice are at play there, right? And that's the piece where, you know, we talked a lot about kind of the fairness of what that adjudication process looks like in the event you do find yourself in that. But also, you know, there was mitigating factors, there was kind of extenuating circumstances as well that all played into that. So, you know, there was a lot of time spent on kind of the intricacies of, if you find yourself in this situation, here's kind of the avenue and pathway that you're going to go through on that.
Within the UFC program, is that something that USADA provided, which would be more analogous to how they have it with the NGBs, or is that something that the UFC provided for the fighters?
In regards to
just the arbiter,
yeah,
that eventually.
I think the UFC paid the independent arbitrator.
Because that's the financial sticking point in a lot of these negotiations. Sure. Is once you go to arbitration, your cost goes up like tenfold.
Yeah,
like it kind of gets ridiculous
and
at that point.
You know, you see that argument a lot in kind of the Olympic space with CAS and just how cost prohibitive it is.
Yeah, from the CAS from being the court of arbitration for sport.
Correct. So I don't quote me on it, but I think the arrangement was, the independent arbitrator had a separate agreement, or the independent arbitration kind of committee had a separate agreement with the UFC on what that kind of ultimately looked like and the costs associated with that were.
Because you had, I mean, during the lifetime of that program, and we're not going to go through all of those because I don't want to give you any more gray hairs, Gabe. There were several high profile instances of where they had to go through that adjudication process. And that is never any fun.
No.
Because it's all in the public spotlight. The athlete brings it into the public spotlight. The anti-doping agency brings it into the public spotlight. And here the agency that the athletes are competing underneath, which is the UFC, brings it into the spotlight as well. The conflicting points all come into the spotlight, and it gets adjudicated both in the court of public appeal, which is always very, very tenuous and tricky. And it also gets adjudicated by a panel of experts or an expert.
Yep.
And those things inevitably come into conflict, which creates a lot of the consternation between the public and anti-doping and athletes and things like that. All of those arenas kind of overlapping at the same time with any one particular issue.
Yeah, it was front and center, you know, kind of day in and day out of that program, right? Like the court of public opinion was quick to judge, as it always is, not just in, you know, the UFC space or sports, but even, I mean, in everything anymore. It just moves so fast, you know, with that. But, you know, I think that process takes time, right? Like it, you know, in order for kind of, like, let's take, for example, if an athlete, you know, is claiming a contaminated product or a contaminated dietary supplement caused their positive test. Well, it takes time to, one, identify what it was, to go source it independently, send it off to a lab, test, confirm it. Okay, that one wasn't it. Let's go through that whole process again. So there's a lengthy, you know, I think, process that needs to play out in order for a fair outcome to be reached.
Yeah, and here's the issue that I've always brought up with that is that the people that are deliberately cheating and the people that genuinely have that happen to them, and there are both in both of the, there are people in both of those categories, use the exact same excuses. I didn't know, I had it contaminated this, my food from whatever burrito truck was contaminated. Yeah. Like it's the exact same thing. And in the court of public opinion, with all due respect to the public, it's impossible to weed through who is telling the truth and who is lying. Even when you get the group of experts in the room, and you've seen the minutes from those meetings, even when you get a group of experts in the room, they will still disagree on points. And these are people who have been doing it for 20 years and do it for a living.
Yep.
So anyway, I don't know why I bring up that whole point, but I'm sure that we will encounter that as we start to unroll different processes, because it's inevitable that we have these two groups of people that are doing very different things. They're saying they're doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, it's the real challenge of the program, right? Like, how do you differentiate between kind of those two claims, you know, with it? And that's where, you know, I think the adjudication process really dives into that. But, you know, the public, 99% of people aren't going to go read a 40-page decision. It's dry legalese, and it's tough to digest. But, like, if you really want to get down to, you know, what drives those outcomes, you have to kind of read through those big lengthy decisions, and they're tough to digest.
Yeah, it is. And like I said, inevitably, it's an inevitability, because every sport has a blueprint to where, or has the same storyline to where they have to come face to face with somebody that everybody loves, that is in this position.
Yeah.
The athlete is saying this, and the court of opinion is saying that, and the anti-doping agency is saying something slightly different, and who's right and who's wrong gets muddled with the personalities that are involved. Yep. I think we should leave it at that. They get muddled with the personalities. How's that?
It's a nasty process.
Okay. I want to give you back the floor a little bit, because the whole purpose of this podcast was to use your experience as a blueprint for how the community can kind of get galvanized around this idea. Is there anything that was really remarkable to you during that entire tenure that you had, either before, during, or now, looking at it on hindsight? Any words of wisdom or any pearl, nuggets that you can give the audience that's listening today, to where they can take it and at least take some initial steps, or as we're going through it, re-listen to this podcast and go, oh yeah, Gabe's told us that this was going to happen.
Yeah. You know, I think stepping back and looking at it from my 6 years of involvement and seeing where that program started from day one to where it was when I stepped away from it in 2017, 2018, whatever it was, you know, the program grew a ton with any new program, you need to be flexible, you need to be nimble.
But you also have to be strict.
Yeah.
That's what's so confounding.
And that's the balance, yeah. I think. But, you know, we saw it on the UFC program. We weren't afraid to change the rules when it was the right thing to do for the athletes. Yeah. In fairness of the athletes, in fairness of the sport. I think anti-doping as a whole is very rigid, right? To your point, your comment is spot on of just the perception of you have to be strict. You have to be strict, yes, but you also need to look at this with a common sense approach from time to time. And it's certainly not a one size fits all approach. And I think there's certainly nuances within the trail running space that I have no idea about that you probably do, and the people that are involved in it say, you know, hey, here's what the UFC did. Here's what WADA does. Here's what professional sports do. There's probably components of each that apply and work. So I would just, you know, I'd say take a kind of a broad approach to it and, you know, focus in on what really matters from the anti-doping perspective. And obviously with, you know, you want to have a strong, fair, robust program that protects the health and safety of runners, that protects the sport as a whole. It's clearly a growing sport that's gaining more and more momentum. It's attracting more big names. It's attracting more sponsorship dollars. The incentive to potentially cheat may only be getting higher and higher. So, you know, I think finding a realistic starting point and building on that is kind of what I would kind of step back and say through my experience, that makes sense to me.
How important is the time frame to get to the starting point? Because you came in.
Yeah.
I went through my fan. Sorry, hit my microphone here. Once again, I went through my fan journey with the UFC. I watched them on Spike TV, on Fox Sports, and then all the way through ESPN. And USADA came in maybe towards the early part, but certainly not at the very beginning.
Yep.
But early enough, at least in my observation, that you didn't have to unwind cycling's problem.
Right. Right.
So I wonder if you can kind of describe to the listeners that, how important it is to get in early enough to where you're not unwinding all these cultural problems and systemic widespread, things going on and stuff like that.
You certainly don't want to be late, right, to the party on
and
that.
They were almost late. I mean, that was kind of...
They were close.
Yeah.
And hence why they ultimately came to us, right? They were really smart and they saw the writing on the wall of the direction the sport was heading, and no different than you and I are sitting here having this conversation today. I think you're seeing where the sport is heading and probably hear the rumor mill circling within, the sport. You know, the sooner the better, right? Is there anyone that's going to make an argument that, we put this anti-doping program in place too soon?
Yeah, nobody's going to say that.
Yeah. So
people will make the argument that it's not enough off the bat.
Sure.
But to your point, you can always start. It's always easier to start and escalate than it is to start and ratchet down.
Yeah.
Because the issue you run into when you start really hot and heavy is you tend to paint yourself into a corner that you can't get back out of because then you're viewed as soft on doping, right?
I think it's a lot harder to unwind perceptions and culture than it is to implement a program.
So don't let the perceptions and culture get into it. Once again, I've said this for the last 3 or 4 years. You've heard me rant on it in any number of breakfasts that we've had together. We still have a good culture that's not static.
Yeah.
It's dynamic. And if you get ahead of the problem before the culture changes, it's way, way easier to change than when you have a rotten culture and you're unwinding all the education and all of the culture and all the bad actions and everything kind of all at once. There's just fewer problems to have the earlier you get into the game.
And I think you're a step ahead of, you know, some sports in ways in that you've got crossover athletes that had competed at an elite level that have been subject to Olympic style drug testing programs that are now competing in trail running or ultra, and they're asking for it in some degrees, right? Like, We need this. We can see where this is heading if it doesn't happen. You also have a landscape where, yes, you have different kind of fractured jurisdictions, but you have the likes of AFLD in France that's already doing something in the space. So there's a certain standard that, you know, athletes are starting to grow accustomed to. You know, not to jump back into kind of the overarching regulator, but, you know, when does the AIU start to look at the sport and say, man, this is gaining some serious momentum, do we need to have a part of this?
Yeah, that's a potential catalyst. The AIU being the Athletes Integrity Union unit. Is that the right acronym? Athletes Integrity Unit. I always forget the last acronym, like agency, right? I always want to say something else. But anyway, I think you're right that it's ripe for somebody, for an organization that currently exists to take over some of this. But I don't think that's all of the solution. Because of this fractured nature, I do think that a big part of it is taking that fractured nature and galvanizing it. And I don't know what the format of that is. I don't profess to have the answer here, but galvanizing that in somewhere. And what I mean by that is taking the brands, taking the races, taking the elite athletes, taking the coaches, anybody who's a key stakeholder, and galvanizing that group together and saying, okay, this is what we all agree upon. You might disagree a little bit here. You might disagree a little bit here, but this is generally what we all agree upon.
Yeah.
Let's kind of go forward with that. I don't think we're kind of like close, but far. I don't know how else to describe
it. Yeah. I think you're probably spot on with that, right? Like, you're starting to have the conversations, you're starting to think about it, which is great, but you're a long way from cup to the lip on some of that. So plenty of room for progress and growth. But yeah, as I step back and I look at kind of the various different sport organizations that have anti-doping programs, regardless of how robust they are, all have some kind of overarching unified body that say, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going
to
do it.
It's hard to do it without, because inevitably you're only as strong as your weakest link.
Sure.
And so the weakest link ends up getting exposed as some sort of difference in opinion on what the rules and what the sanctions should be, which are two kind of fundamental pieces of it. What are the rules? How do you enforce them? And what are the sanctions on the back end of it? Even when you have an organizing system, those things come into conflict and typically get exposed the most. So you can imagine that if there's not an overarching body that sets the tone for all of that, how much more of that consternation would actually exist. Yeah. And that's kind of what scares me about the fractured nature right now. Recently, we were remarking before the podcast came on, I had our intern, Zat Finsky, shout out to you for doing this for me. I had him go out and survey the landscape of all of the races that have some sort of anti-doping rules or framework. And there's no consistency between any, and nor would you expect there to be. I'm not doubting the efforts of those races to actually do something. I actually applaud them for doing something and not nothing.
Yep.
But when you line them all up, some of them do in competition testing. Some of them say that you're subject to out of competition testing. Some of them ban NSAIDs, right? Ibuprofen and things like that. Yeah. Some of them adhere to the WADA code. Some of them adhere to both the WADA code and the WADA watch list, interestingly enough. So I don't know how they're going to test for that, but the things that might be banned next year, they also test for that, and that would be considered a prohibitive substance in that one particular race. And so my point with all of that is if we use that as a little bit of a blueprint for the fractured nature, my fear is that fracturing continues to propagate where everybody's kind of got their own opinion, and then nobody can keep track of the rules. That's why the overarching body is extremely important, so that everybody can play by the same set of rules. Because at the end of the day, and you know this just as much as anybody else, that's all the athletes want. They just want to know what the freaking rules are so they can stay on the right side of it.
Yeah. And you know, the fact that athletes are starting to ask for that is, I think, a huge step, right? Like if you had the flip side of that where athletes didn't want it, I'd be way more concerned about it ever happening, right? Versus that you have a concerted effort from a group of athletes that are starting to ask for it and push for it is a huge step in the right direction. And they'll be the ones who I think ultimately can drive it across the finish line.
Yeah. Ultimately, I do think that the athletes have to want it the most.
Yeah.
And if I get any comfort in this whole process, despite all my misgivings and frustrations and things like that, with the lack of progress of which I've had a lot that I've expressed on this podcast and in privately as well, I'm heartened by the fact that the athletes want it so much. They might not all want they might not all want the same thing or the exact same thing, but they all still want something. And I think that will eventually win out. That willpower will eventually win out.
Yep.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for your counsel over the years, by the way. We always have a fun time when we get together.
We do. There's no shortage of fun stuff to talk through.
I'm sure this is just the first of many. Will you continue to be a resource for me, Gabe?
I certainly will be.
Thanks, man. If you ever need to pick my brain about stuff, which I don't know why you would want to, I'm always available.
I have in the past, and I will continue to. So
thanks, man. Anything else you want to leave the listeners with? Normally, I give the chance for people to plug their own stuff, but you already have a baked-in audience with your business.
Yeah. So. Yeah, we're niche enough where I'm not sure it's going to resonate all that well. But no, I just appreciate the opportunity to be on and fun to talk through this stuff.
Thank you. I'm glad, man.
I can lend my past experience to hopefully set ultra and trail running up for success in the future.
We're going to figure it out.
You will.
Eventually.
Hang in there.
All right, folks. There you have it. There you go. Much thanks to Gabe for coming on the podcast today. And more importantly, Gabe, thank you for all the personal counsel that you have given me over the years. And thank you for the counsel that you have now given to the trail and ultra running community. As we mentioned throughout the course of this podcast, I do think that a lot of the learning lessons that Gabe experienced during his time at USADA and specifically with this program within the UFC are great learning lessons and a great blueprint for what we can do in trail and ultra running. It's going to take a little bit of willpower, a little bit of money, and a little bit of everybody coming together to figure it out. But I do believe that all the elements are there to take some initial steps. So thank you, Gabe, for coming on the podcast. I appreciate all the listeners out there for putting up with the last 4 weeks of podcasts that were all about the same thing. These are not going to be my most popular podcasts. They're not going to be the most downloaded. They're not going to be the most liked. They're not going to be the most shared. And I don't care, because I think that they are the most important. That's one of the great things about not having to monetize my podcast, is I can kind of do whatever I want. I do hope that if anybody out there, and in particular the key stakeholders, the elite athletes, the race directors, the brand managers, and the coaches of elite athletes, I do hope that you have taken all of the information over the course of the last 4 weeks to heart, because it is our responsibility to shape the community going forward, and we all play a role in that. There is something for everybody in all of that, whether you're a coach, an athlete, brand manager, race director. We can all take something from what we've discussed over the course of the last 4 weeks and do something with it to push this thing forward. The learning doesn't stop, though. Not yet. Because the moment that this podcast gets released, I am going to release a free edition of my research newsletter, Research Essentials for Ultra Running, that is all about, you guessed it, an anti-doping theme. Every single month, the research team and myself, we review 3 papers that are pertinent to the trail and ultra marathon space. And this month's issue is going to be all about anti-doping, and it is going to be for free, unpaywalled. You don't have to register your email address. I'm not going to spam you after the fact. I want you to download it and send it to your friends. Copy it, plagiarize it, do whatever you want to get this information out there. So please go to my website, jasoncoop.com/research essentials for ultra running. It will be the very first thing that you see. You will not have to enter anything, and I will not crawl and try to find you around the web in any way, shape, or form, because all I want to do is I want this information to get out there in the public so that the future of the sport continues to be as healthy as it is right now, and even healthier once we get one of these systems in place. So y'all go and check that out. I hope that everybody has taken the information to heart that we have had over the course of the last 4 weeks. We will be back to our regular scheduled programming next week with another killer edition of the Coopcast. Appreciate the heck out of each and every one of you out there. And as always, we will see you out on the trails.